CFRC 101.9 FM has new social media. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at CFRC Music and keep up with the latest announcements about our programming and projects. Follow us today at CFRC Music.
Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. The Kingston Film Heritage Project and Vulnerable Media Lab have partnered to bring a Home Movie Day event to Kingston in October. Home Movie Day has been an annual celebration of home movies and immature films held at venues worldwide since 2003, started by a group of film archivists concerned about what would happen to all the home movies shot on film during the 20th century. The event gives community members an opportunity to see their films on the big screen, as well as have their memories digitized for free. Home Movie Day events also often include tips for preserving films. It was announced that Saturday, October 19th, will be the inaugural event for Kingston, taking place at the Screening Room. All proceeds for this event will also be going towards All Our Relations Land Trust, a charitable organization led by Indigenous peoples committed to supporting and protecting the environment in the Kingston area. The theme for films this year is transience. To learn more about this first-time event for the city, CFRC sat down with organizer Adam Cook. Here is a bit of that conversation. This year, the Kingston Film Heritage Project and Vulnerable Media Lab announced Home Movie Day 2024. So this has been kind of a named event since early 2000s. What is Home Movie Day?
Yeah, Home Movie Day started over 20 years ago. Basically, a group of film archivists were concerned about what was going to happen to all the home movies shot on film specifically during the 20th century, a kind of concern that we share at the Vulnerable Media Lab, which is housed in the Film and Media Department at Queen's. And it's an annual event held around the world with different participating cities where local home movies are exhibited for a public audience. This is the inaugural edition in Kingston, and we're really excited to be the ones hosting the first ever Home Movie Day in Kingston.
Yeah, awesome. What was sort of the inspiration to bring it to Kingston, and how are you and your team feeling about spearheading this inaugural year?
Yeah, well, it comes naturally to us working in the Vulnerable Media Lab, which is a state-of-the-art historic media transfer remediation and restoration research lab. Basically, we scan, digitize, and restore various media, including celluloid film, but not limited to it, mini DV tapes, VHS, etc., etc. So we're always looking to embark on new projects internally at the lab, but also curatorially. We like to, engage with the public, engage with Kingston, and specifically with the Kingston Film Heritage Project, which we've been running for some months now. We're looking to engage with the city's history, archival materials of the city, and now in the case of Home Movie Day, material produced by locals or people living here. It's okay if they're just passing through too. Our theme for the first edition is transience.
Yeah, for sure. And could you get into that theme a little bit, transience? What was the choice there, and what does that mean exactly?
Well, what it means is something that we're happy to leave to the interpretation of those curious about submitting. Transience, of course, could really be used to describe home movies and vulnerable media in general, of course, the temporary nature of things, of material, but also the passage of time. Home movies are typically linked with nostalgia, so it seemed fitting to go with the theme of transience, but we wanted to keep it as open-ended as possible to let the folks who might have some home movies up in their attic or whatever that they want to dig out, some creativity when they're thinking of submitting to us.
Awesome. Yeah. And you describe this media as vulnerable. And of course, it's in the title there, Vulnerable Media Lab. I was wondering if you could get into a bit of what that means.
Yeah, well, of course, I'm sure people kind of envision celluloid film, 16 millimeter, 35 millimeter, Super 8, what have you, as being vulnerable. We know that it deteriorates over time unless it's kept in really ideal conditions. We do have our own vault, our own archive in the film and media department where we preserve a lot of different film. But actually, digital media is arguably just as vulnerable. It's a bit of a misnomer that it's celluloid film that is. So really, any kind of media, including contemporary forms of it, are all vulnerable to different forms of expiry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So I guess this event, yeah, it's about nostalgia, preservation. And yeah, are you hoping that this event will continue to be an annual thing in the future? Or are you guys just kind of rolling with it this year?
Well, ideally, yeah. I think it would be wonderful if this could be an annual event in Kingston and ongoing as part of the Kingston Film Heritage Project. What it actually turns out to be is really in the hands of the people listening to this right now. Submissions are open now, and we are open to anything, really. If people want information about how to submit their home movies, potentially have them digitized for their own posterity, and then potentially projected on the big screen, they can do so now. If they go to the Screening Room website, because that's where we will be hosting the screening, you'll find information there, or they can email me at 22ac18@queensu.ca for more information. So it's up to the people who submit their home movies what kind of content we'll get, and how much, what the volume of submissions will be. Hopefully it's popular. It's important to us to keep the barriers to a minimum for this event. So it is pay what you can, with proceeds going to a charity, all our Relations Land Trust. And we'll be accepting submissions for the rest of the month, and then hosting the screening October 19th at 1 p.m. at the Screening Room.
Awesome. Yeah. And like you just said there, there's still quite a while to submit. Have you received any submissions so far? How's it looking?
Well, the submission process, we wanted to kind of make as easy as possible, both for those submitting and for ourselves. So submitting your home movie actually doesn't involve sharing your home movie with us. You just have to fill out a quick form. Honestly, it takes about 5 minutes to fill out. We just want to hear a little bit about what it is that you are thinking of submitting. And then based on that, we're going to contact a handful of people and get in touch with them about getting a hold of their home movies. And those are the ones that we'll digitize and project on October 19th.
Submissions for home movies to digitize and feature at the screening are being accepted until the end of September. You can visit screeningroomkingston.com for more details. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News on Kingston's very first home movie day. That wraps up your headlines for this evening, and next up is Jesse Bell with your CFRC Sports Desk.
This is Jesse Bell from the CFRC Sports Desk, and this is your sports report. The Gaels were in the nation's capital on Saturday looking for program win number 500. They took on the 2-1 Ottawa Gigis at Gigi's Field in a game noteworthy for its sweltering summer temperatures. Ottawa's first drive of the game was a good one, but stalled out in the Queens red zone, leading to a field goal attempt by number 13th of the Gigis, Zachary Copeland. Copeland pushed it to the right, meaning that Queens had a chance to run this one back for a touchdown.
But it's going
to
be wide, and here we go. One of the most explosive playmakers in the OUA, Ian St. Arnaud, taking this one. He's making a couple men miss. He is still up on his feet. If he's going to get this done, he's got a lot of work to do. He's breaking down the right-hand side of the field. He's got one man to beat. He cuts it in. He cuts it back. Oh, my goodness! Oh! He did it again!
That's it for your Gaels! Three in a row!
I have never in my life seen someone like this. Lightning has struck a third time in 2 weeks.
The Gales offense would score on their first drive, making it 14-0 early in the first quarter, and then another special teams miscue from the GGs, this time a blocked punt returned by Queens number 46, Jeremy Hiscox, gave the Gales a 21-0 lead at the end of the first quarter. The Queens offense would struggle a great deal in the second quarter with two consecutive Alex Vreekin interceptions, which gave Ottawa some much-needed momentum. The GGs got the game within 11, trailing 31-20 at halftime. The Gales' third quarter began poorly with another Alex Vreekin interception, but the Queens defense would bail their offense out with this fantastic play by number 26, Keegan Vanek.
Miracle rolling out again. That time he gets hit. That is big.
Keegan Vanek, baby.
And you can put it on the board. That is 6 points for your Gales. Number 26. Vanek victimizes Miracle again. And that one is going to hurt all the more as the Gales put six more on the board.
He sees those GGs and he is just gunning for that interception.
Vanek's interception return for a touchdown gave the Gales a 38-20 lead. They would add 10 more points over the next quarter and a half and shut out the Ottawa offense in the second half to walk away with a 48-20 victory. Vanek had a career day with two interceptions, including one return for a touchdown and a punt block. Meanwhile, on special teams, Ian St. Arnaud has had the most successful 7-day stretch of any special teams player in Canadian history, with 3 touchdowns and over 500 return yards in a 7-day period, starting on September 7th against York, and being capped off with another virtuoso performance on September 14th against the Ottawa GGs. The 3-1 Gales will host the 3-1 Guelph Griffins this upcoming Saturday, September 21st at Richardson Memorial Stadium. Kickoff is scheduled for 3 p.m. and CFRC will be live with the Something in the Water pregame show at 2:45. On Saturday, September 21st, two perennial powerhouse programs in the OUA will go toe-to-toe at Richardson Memorial Stadium. Your Queens Gales will host the Guelph Griffins. Last year, the Gales and the Griffins waged war in a classic contest that went down to the wire. Can the Griffins get their revenge, or will the Gales stay golden at Richardson Stadium? There's only one way to find out, and that's to tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Join us for our pregame show at 2:45 p.m. Kickoff is scheduled for 3. Trust me, folks, you don't want to miss this one.
This is Christina coming in with your CFRC weather report for this evening. Tonight, we're expecting clear skies with fog patches developing overnight, and we have a low of 13 degrees. Looking forward to tomorrow, Tuesday, September 17th, we're expecting sunny skies with fog patches dissipating in the morning. We have a high of 27 degrees with humidex that's going to feel like 34, and we have a UV index of 6 or high. Tuesday night, we'll have cloudy periods with a low of 16. On Wednesday, September 18th, we're expecting cloudy skies with a high of 23, and for the night, cloudy skies with a low of 16. On Thursday, September 19th, we have a mix of sun and cloud and a high of 25 degrees, and at night, clear skies with a low of 15. On Saturday, September 21st, we're expecting a mix of sun and cloud with a high of 22 degrees, and at night, cloudy periods with a low of 11. Finally, finishing off the week, on Sunday, September 22nd, we'll have a mix of sun and cloud and a high of 21. That wraps up your CFRC weather report for this evening, and next up is your CFRC weekly traffic report.
This is your CFRC weekly traffic report. I'm Michael Bulos. Pavement rehabilitations will take place along Highway 401 between Westbrook Road to beyond the Highway 15 overpass and on Sir John A. Macdonald Overpass. This work will consist of various lane and ramp closures over the next several months. Sir John A. Macdonald Boulevard ramp closures will be from September 18th, overnight from 8 p.m. to 6 p.m. Highway 401 westbound at Highway 15 will have a full mainline closure over the following days. September 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. Public Services and Procurement Canada wishes to advise users that the LaSalle Causeway will be fully closed to motorists, cyclists, and pedestrians until further notice. Road closures. Albert Street, Princess to 486 Albert Street, closed until December 31st to accommodate construction, activity, and staging at 484 Albert Street. Bagot Street, Barrie to West, closed September 15th from 11:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. for the Battle of Britain Parade. Barrie Street, Stewart to Bagot, closed September 15th from 11:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. for the Battle of Britain Parade. Churchill Crescent, College North to College South, closed September 14th from 2 p.m. to 7 p.m. for the annual Neighborhood Street Festival. Concession Street, Lansdowne to Alfred, closed September 15th from 6:30 a.m. to 6 p.m. for a gas service installation. Cooper Street, Albert to Collingwood, closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Davidson Street, Pembroke to Ellerbeck, closed September 14th from 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. for the Livingston Ave block party. Edwin Street, Collins Bay to Waverly, closed until September 18th for the removal and reinstatement of asphalt. Hillcrest Ave, Kings Court to 7th, closed until October 31st for buried infrastructure replacement. Road will be open to local traffic. Joyceville Road at CN Rail Tracks closed September 15th at 5 p.m. to September 18th at 6 p.m. for crossing repairs. Detours will be in place for the duration of this closure. Kings Court Avenue, Hillcrest to Kirkpatrick, closed until November 15th to accommodate a water main replacement. King Street, Place d'Armes to north end of King, closed until September 30th for the construction of new storm and roadbed. Road will be open to local traffic. Livingston Avenue, King to Union, closed September 14th from 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. for the Livingston Ave block party. Sydenham Street, Princess to Queen, closed until September 27th for downtown Kingston BIA activations. Union Street, Victoria to Albert, closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. University Avenue, Union to Earl, closed for construction-related activity at Queen's John Deutsch University Center project. Parking disruption. The Hanson Memorial Parking Structure Restoration Project is now underway. The work will take place throughout all levels of the building and will include efforts such as routine structural maintenance, repainting, replacement of waterproofing materials, and upgrades to the building's mechanical and electrical systems. The work is planned to begin the first week of February 2024 and conclude in late December 2024. The work will be completed in phases to allow the building to remain open to public for the duration of the project. It is anticipated that no more than 50% of the available 271 parking spaces will be closed at any time. There is also parking availability at the Chown Memorial and Robert Bruce Memorial parking garages in the two adjacent blocks to the west. Other delays. Aberdeen Street, Johnson to Earl, expect delays and closures along Aberdeen Street for a contractor to complete road and sewer reconstruction. Bayridge Drive, Princess to Taylor Kidd, expect delays while a contractor begins phase 2 of the Bayridge Drive active transportation upgrades. Collins Bay Road, Prince Charles Edwin to Princess, expect delays while a contractor completes phase 2 of the Princess and Collins Bay active transportation improvements. Gardner's Road at Centennial Creekford, expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abbey Dawn to St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbey Dawn Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Ontario Street, Brock to Clarence, expect a southbound lane closure September 17th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. to facilitate the installation of vinyl wraps on the planters at City Hall. D Detours will be in place for the duration of the closure.
Thanks so much. Here's your CFRC concert calendar for today. On Monday, September 16th, check out the Monday Afternoon Jazz Jam led by Oscar Evans at the RCHA. The show starts at 4:30 p.m. and is $5. Also on Monday night, you can check out Authority Zero, Belvedere, Melon Ball, and the Meringues at the Broom Factory for $25 in support of the Meringues' latest album release starting at 7:30 p.m. On Tuesday, September 17th, Tom's Tuesday Afternoon Happy Hour Jam with host Tom Savage is back. Drop by the RCHA from 4 to 7 p.m. for a free show. Also on Tuesday, Lal and Yarrow are playing a by-donation show at the Next Church starting at 7 p.m. On Wednesday, September 18th, Canadian singer-songwriter legend Martha Wainwright takes the stage at the Broom Factory starting at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are $40. Also on Wednesday, you can check out Hemingford, Quebec folk duo The Co-Conspirators for free at Hotel Wolf Island, starting at 6 p.m. Later that evening, Too Many Zoos will play a show at the Mansion starting at 8:30 p.m., and tickets are $30. On Thursday, September 19th, you can see Michael George for $5 at the RCHA starting at 7 p.m. Open Season Thursdays with Chris Brown, Joey Wright, and Jason Mercer starts at 7 p.m., Thursdays at Hotel Wolf Island. You can also check out Rev Zed, Mason FM, and the Clay Pigeons for only $5 at the Mansion on September 12th from 8:30 to 11:30 p.m. On Friday, September 20th, you can see Cazador with Sparrow Blue, The High Loves, and Julia Finnegan at the Broom Factory starting at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are $23. You can also join the Happy Hour TJIF at the RCHA featuring a performance by the Smokin' Roosters, a free event starting at 4 p.m. Then stick around for Whiskey Smoke, a country duo featuring Amanda Sorensen and Mike Grice at the RCHA for $5 starting at 8 p.m. Also on Friday, you can enjoy some chill folk rock by Chris Gagier and the Larks for free at Musiki Cafe starting at 8 p.m. Ottawa folk artist Graven with Stephen Stanley will play a show at Hotel Wolf Island on Friday, starting at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are $25. And Friday night, starting at 8, folks can dance it up for free at Springer Market Square with music by DJ Trueways. On Saturday, September 21st, folks can drive out to Westport for West Porch 2024 to enjoy live free country, bluegrass, jazz, blues, folk, rock, and more music from front porches in downtown Westport, a free event running all day. Also on Saturday, you can go see Mo Kenny, Piner, and Marlo Green at the Broom Factory. The show starts at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are $20. Dead Root Revival will also play at RCHA on Saturday night starting at 8 p.m. Tickets are $20. CFRC's own John McClurg will play a show at the Cove Inn in Westport by donation starting at 5 p.m. You can also catch China Cat Riders with the Cherry Garcia Band for free at Hotel Wolf Island on Saturday night starting at 8:30 p.m. On Sunday, September 22nd, you can enjoy a show by Jake Fadlin and the Sturgeon River Boys at the Broom Factory, starting at 2 p.m. Also on Sunday, check out the Brick House Polka Band and Celtic Kitchen Party at Daff Brewing, starting at 1 p.m. Tickets are $25. You can also enjoy some dinnertime jazz by donation at Hotel Wolf Island, starting at 4 p.m. And also on Sunday, Christina Foster and Anna Sudak are playing a show in support of the Little Cat Arakwe Creek Conservation Area's 60th anniversary. The show at Little Cat starts at 1 p.m. and is $5. Have a concert you would like to add to our online and on-air concert calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca. Here's your CFRC events calendar for today. On September 16th through the end of the month, you can join the Kingston Writers Fest Reading Challenge by reading books on the KWF reading list and be entered into contests to get tickets to see authors in person at the upcoming festival. Learn more on the KWF website. Also on Monday, September 16th, you can head over to the Art and Media Lab at the Isabel Bader Center for the Performing Arts for an exhibit by award-winning artist Evan Sharma called My Experiments in Hope, a free event. Also at 6 p.m. on the 16th, you can enjoy free summer swing dancing at the Newlands Pavilion Gazebo by Murney Tower. The Brass and One-Eyed Jacks will host their weekly trivia games starting at 7 and 7:45 p.m. respectively. On Tuesday, September 17th, the Kingston Public Market is open from 8:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Springer Market Square. On Tuesday, you can also grab your runners and head over to Lululemon downtown at 5:30 p.m. for a weekly fun run. Jog, mingle, and have fun. This run is for all ages and abilities. You can also head over on Tuesday evening to Spearhead Brewing for board games night starting at 4 p.m. On Wednesday, September 18th, head over to the Rideau Heights Community Center for the Fresh Food Market pop-up, featuring fresh, healthy, and affordable food options between 2 and 5 p.m. Also on Wednesday, there will be a public talk called Empowering Neurodivergence, Harnessing Strengths for Success. Watch party will be held at Duncan MacArthur Hall from 7:30 to 9 p.m. Something in the Water Brewing and Daft Brewing will host their trivia nights starting at 7 p.m. And One Eye Jacks will host North End Board Games Night for free, also starting at 7 p.m. On Thursday, September 19th, Kingston Community Health Centers will host a senior social group for folks ages 55 and over from 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. Also on Thursday, Nobel laureate Dr. David E. Card will present a talk called Cause and Effect and Evidence-Based Policies, a W.A. McIntosh public lecture taking place in Stirling Hall at Queen's University from 4 to 5:30 p.m. Also on Thursday, head over with your runners to Runner's Choice for the weekly Out in Front running group for 2SLGBTQ+ runners ready to run at 6:15 p.m. for 5 to 6 kilometers, followed by a post-run social. You can also check out the musical All I Really Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten at the Spire from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m., a show running nightly through the 21st. On Friday, September 20th, the YMCA will host its Fresh Food Pop-Up Market, featuring healthy food options that won't break the bank. Also on Friday from 6 to 9 p.m., you can attend a Pet Bulls pottery making workshop and learn to make a custom pet bowl at Amaranth Stoneware out on 745 Development Drive. Registration is $70. On Saturday, September 21st, the Kingston Public Market runs from 8:30 to 4 p.m. in Springer Market Square. Also on Saturday, the Friends of Lemoyne Point Fall Tree, Shrub, and Wildflower Sale will take place from 9 till noon at the Lemoyne Point Conservation Area. Princess Street Promenade also returns on Saturday from 10 to 5, running down Princess Street from Barrie to Ontario. Folks can also check out the Foraging for the Seasons workshop running at the Calvin Park branch of the Kingston Frontenac Public Library from 1 to 3 p.m. and learn about foraging wild edible foods. You can also enjoy a free observatory tour and astrophysics talk called From Dust Grains to Stars and Shots in the Dark by Queen's PhD candidate Parissa Nozari, a public event at the Queen's Observatory taking place from 7:30 to 10 p.m. You can also have a chance to look through the telescope into the night sky, weather permitting. On Sunday, September 22nd, get up early and head over to Runner's Choice for an early morning long run starting at 8:30 p.m. Also on Sunday, the Kingston Intercultural Arts Festival runs from 11:30 a.m. to 7 p.m. at Confederation Park. And finally, the Memorial Center Farmers Market will take place from 9 to 2 p.m. featuring food, artisanal crafts, and music. Have a concert or event you would like to add to our online or on-air concert calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca. Don't forget to follow CFRC on Instagram at cfrcmusic.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
So far somewhere else.
Attention all creatives. Join us at the Makers Meetup on October 1st from 4 to 6 p.m. at the Broom Factory. Whether you're a filmmaker, musician, digital creator, or just passionate about Kingston's creative scene, this event is the perfect opportunity to network, collaborate, and share ideas. Plus, we'll be revealing the official pairings for this year's Slate Music Video Program. Come see which local artists and production companies will be teaming up. Don't miss out on this exciting, free event. For more information, visit visitkingston.ca/music. See you there.
I've changed my mind. Time and time, conflicting thoughts, debate what's for the better.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. This is edition 233. Thanks for tuning in. I'm going to be sharing a conversation I had with Adam Shapiro. Adam is a longtime human rights activist and organizer, one of the founders of the International Solidarity Movement. That is a global movement that for many years until today has been inviting human rights defenders and activists from around the world to stand witness and to be on the ground in occupied Palestine. This organization has had major ripple effects around the world, bringing thousands of young people to the ground in Palestine to support the Palestinian struggle for freedom. I thought it was important to speak with Adam in this current context, in the context of this global movement of solidarity with the Palestinian people, the global movement of total opposition to the Israeli genocidal military attacks from the government against the Palestinian people in Gaza. So I'll just leave it there and share my conversation with Adam Shapiro here on Free City Radio.
This is an unprecedented moment with mobilizations happening around the world in support of Palestinian freedom. Of course, on the other side of this political equation is this genocidal campaign on the part of the Israeli state that is unprecedented, and the disregard and attack on Palestinian life has reached this horrifying level. So you've been involved in Palestine solidarity work for decades and have meaningfully contributed to a lot of grassroots space to mobilize. So I was really interested to hear your perspective on sort of both the importance of this unprecedented mobilization, but also any thoughts about, for those listening who are sort of maybe supportive of what's happening and watching what's happening, but aren't as connected to thinking about how this moment comes from years of organizing. And I'm saying this also to think about the future, right? Like, how do you carry this type of momentum forward? So maybe you could just introduce yourself and share any thoughts about that. Thank you, Adam.
Sure. So thank you for this opportunity. My name is Adam Shapiro, and I was one of the co-founders of the International Solidarity Movement in Palestine back in 2001. I also helped organize the Freedom Flotillas to Gaza and was on one of the ships in 2009, and then to the flotilla 2010 and 2011. Have been involved with documenting the lives of Palestinians through documentary film and other types of advocacy efforts for a couple of decades now. I think, one thing I would say is that, and I think it's important for your listeners to understand, is that, you know, while we are at an unprecedented moment in so many ways, I think sometimes when we hear the word unprecedented, or people hear the word unprecedented, they think that it kind of popped out of nowhere. And that's definitely not the case, right? I mean, if we want to just look at the mass mobilizations that are happening in the streets in cities around the world, yes, we're reaching levels of participation and sustained participation. I'm thinking about London on Saturdays. I'm thinking about, you know, Istanbul. I'm thinking about here in the United States, in Washington, D.C., where we've had two major mobilizations that are really unprecedented in this country. But this builds on, you know, years and years and years of increased activism, increased organization or organizing for Palestinian rights, which has at times resulted in mass mobilization. So I'm thinking back to around the time that the Second Intifada started, and there were huge protests in support of Palestinian rights across the world. I'm thinking about the anniversary in 2008, the 60th anniversary of the Nakba, where there were major commemorations across the world in terms of mobilizations. I'm thinking about even going back to Durban and the anti-racism conference, in which you had really like an incredible outpouring of support for Palestinian rights and recognizing Zionism as racism. So this is not something that came out of nowhere. And it's something that has been built on the shoulders and the struggles of peoples, you know, even going back into the 60s, 70s, 80s. This is, you know, for almost as long as there's been an issue about, you know, and the repression of Palestinian rights, there's been global movements and global efforts to support and act in solidarity with Palestinians. What I think we saw in the second, with the second Intifada, more than any previous time, and that has been sustained now for 20 years, is this effort to manifest solidarity in two ways that can have impact, like real impact. One is on the ground, and so that's with things like the International Solidarity Movement and other efforts that cropped up following the Second Intifada to bring people to Palestine and to stand and act in solidarity with Palestinians on the ground, whether it means joining demonstrations and protests there, you know, protecting houses, protecting fields, crops, standing up to settlers and settler violence, standing up to the military. And there was a heavy price to be paid for that. Rachel Corey, who is one of our members, was killed in Gaza. Tom Herndahl was killed in Gaza. Others have been injured severely. Brian Avery and others. So this is something that, you know, I think the manifestation of solidarity in this practical way on the ground was a huge phenomenon and continues to this day, despite efforts by the Israelis to stop it. And that then fed into the second level, I think, of meaningful and impactful solidarity, which has been in many ways spearheaded or at least coordinated by the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement and the academic and cultural boycott of Israel movement, which has been to say, okay, you've been to Palestine. People who went wanted to come home and do something in their communities, recognizing that this conflict, if we want to call it a conflict, was not just between Israelis and Palestinians. It was Israelis plus all of their enablers and aiders and abettors in apartheid and now genocide and everything through the provision of weapons and funds and, you know, financial perks and all kinds of stuff and normalization of those of that repression. And so these people, when they came back to their communities, wanted to act in a way. And part of that acting was just raising awareness in their communities, speaking out, speaking up in their church groups, in their synagogues, in their mosques, and not just religious institutions, in the universities and schools and their associations and unions and whatever. And then BDS came along and became this call from Palestinian civil society to the globe, to global solidarity activists, and said, hey, we need to actually impose a cost, the same way South Africans did in confronting apartheid, the way others have done over the years in confronting the tobacco industry in the United States or really globally and other sectors, and try to impose a cost on Israel for maintaining its occupation and apartheid practices. And that led to this, you know, increased mobilization of people to become consumer boycotts, to target, you know, financial institutions, pension funds, things like that, and do it through their institutions themselves. So getting churches and other and unions and others to withdraw support that had been given, often without consultation with their members, to the state of Israel. And so I think that manifestation of solidarity in this practical way has led us to where we are today when this, you know, genocide started unfolding after October 7th, which is that people largely believed that, I think there was this shattering of a belief with this action by Israel to commit genocide in Gaza, which is that there could be a way to confront Israel and get it to change through more civil efforts like boycott, divestment, and sanctions, nonviolence certainly, but more kind of like, let's just work through systems and processes that we've set up or that others have used before us, and this will help change behavior. Instead, what we've seen is the exact opposite. It has not only not changed behavior, it's that behavior has become even more entrenched by Israel, and we've had the effort to turn, you know, the label of anti-Semitism into a weapon against anybody that dares question the practices, the repressive practices of Israel. And so activists who were joining, and I'm not talking about necessarily the hardcore activists like myself or you or others who've long faced charges of, you know, being either anti-Semitic or hating Jews or different kind of things, being called terrorists. But now even sort of like people who I would say are almost like armchair activists, you know, who are signing petitions or just trying to like protest something at their in their community, are now being smeared and tainted with this label, which now is being, you know, painted with a huge paintbrush across the canvas. And that, I think, has now shattered this illusion that somehow this project, this Zionist project, this colonial settler state, this apartheid regime, this genocidal regime, can somehow be, its behavior can be changed through, you know, political pressure and, you know, just making a better argument, let's say, or imposing some economic, you know, small economic cost. Instead, people, I think, are taking to the streets and realizing that actually what needs to happen is a complete disruption. And that's where we're at an unprecedented level of mobilization. It's not just the numbers of people going out. It's that a lot of the actions that are happening, at which a lot of people are participating, is aimed to disrupt normal life, daily life for people in our countries around the world, where we might not be the Israelis, our governments may not be the Israeli government, but our governments are supporting the Israeli government and making it possible for Israel to continue and doing, you know, committing this genocide and stopping it themselves from taking any measures through international institutions like the UN or other bodies from using those, you know, avenues for trying to get Israel to stop its behavior. And so this idea now, I think, that is caught on is that as long as there's genocide going on, and I would hope even after, you know, whenever there is a ceasefire, that the activism doesn't stop, there can't be business as usual, life as normal anywhere. And, you know, I think it's fantastic. I think it's, you know, I'm in awe of a lot of the activists who've come up. You know, when we started sailing ships to Gaza, we were seen as utterly insane. We saw ourselves as utterly insane in a lot of ways. But we felt it was the thing that needed to be done. And, you know, nothing else was breaking that concept of blockade on Gaza. There were efforts to manage it. There were efforts to work with it. There were efforts to make it less devastating. But nothing that basically said, other than our flotillas, that said this has to stop, that this is not possible for people to live under this kind of regime. And now that's become normalized. This idea that, like, the genocide has to stop through disruption is now the common sort of bond and organizing principle, I think, among all these groups globally that are working to organize against Israel and its practices in Gaza at this point. And yeah, it's really, it is unprecedented, not just for Palestine, but if we think about, you know, I'm old enough to remember the protests around the Iraq War and the United States and others going to war in Iraq in 2003. And I remember that we did have major turnout. We had, you know, in Washington, D.C., where I was based, and in New York, where I went, we had sometimes a million people turn out. But it was all kind of very, you show up for a protest and you go home and you feel like you've accomplished something because you've shown up. But there was very little done in those days, and definitely not anything done by significant numbers of people to really try to disrupt what ultimately became the invasion of Iraq, and what a disaster that was. So this really is in many ways not just unprecedented for Palestine, but unprecedented for global solidarity about any issue. And maybe it does take going back and thinking about the global effort around ending apartheid in South Africa to even see something akin to what we're seeing today.
Thanks for sharing that, Adam. I really appreciate it. There will be, you know, people who are seeing the events in Gaza unfold all around the world who, some may have gone to protests, some maybe weren't able to for various reasons, but there does seem to be an understanding at a very grassroots level
that, you know, if we want to be very basic, that what's happening in Gaza is just unacceptable. And I think hearing this context you shared was really important. But also for those listening, like, what would you say to people who feel a certain powerlessness in terms of, like, thinking about the impact of protests? You know, if we think about, you know, Western contexts, let's say, you know, quote unquote Western contexts, like the United States or Canada, you could argue that the protests in Canada had an effect on pushing the government to call for a ceasefire. The same with France. But, you know, U.S. is super important. And the demand for a ceasefire is super basic. But still, like, what are your thoughts about the importance of going out? You know, Jeremy Corbyn was speaking outside of the ICC, and I loved one thing he mentioned, which was that every time you go outside of your house to decide to speak against injustice, that's a small step, and it's an important one. So I'd love to hear your thoughts about this, because I'm sure you've had a lot of ups and downs in this whole trajectory that you're describing.
I mean, first, I think the first thing to that folks should, at least, you know, the way I at least appreciate it, is that going out and protesting is not going to result in a change tomorrow. It's about being part of, and maybe just for yourself, starting a process that has a longer term, that's going to try to affect longer term change. And sometimes that longer term change is getting a government to move from doing nothing or saying even supportive statements for, in this case, Israel's genocide, to shifting and moving to a ceasefire. And we shouldn't take that for granted, and we shouldn't take it for granted that would happen inevitably. We are seeing, you know, in the United States that is not inevitable. And that, you know, every day we're seeing more and more and more elected officials, city councils coming forward with resolutions or statements calling for ceasefire. And if it happened on day 102 of this genocide, it didn't happen on day 101. And part of what's getting people and systems to change, you know, and groups to change their positions is this public pressure that is sustained and that is out there. So if you're thinking about going to protest and you're thinking, oh, my participation doesn't matter or it's not going to change anything. Well, one, it does change things. You just have to think about the window of time you're looking at and what kind of things you're looking to change. And then secondly, yeah, one more person in a group of 400,000 people, maybe it doesn't seem like a lot, but I'll tell you from my own experience, and this is something I've come to appreciate now that I've lived in one place for a longer period of time. When I go out to a protest here, and I live in outside Detroit in Michigan, I tell the people around me who are not at all connected to Palestine. I just to give you an example, I play soccer, football, with a group of guys who are from Brazil. And they're working here in Michigan, they, you know, mainly in the auto sector, and like they're not really that concerned with, you know, what's going on in other parts of the world, and they're mainly, you know, they're interested in Brazil, certainly, so there is like an international element there. But like, you know, I don't even know what part of the political spectrum they're from, you know, in Brazil. But we play football together, and I'm sure that when I, you know, I make it a point that I said, you know, like when we're talking about, hey, how are you catching up, that I told them I went to a protest over the weekend and it was for Palestine. And that just starts getting the conversation going. And they now know somebody who's turned up to a protest that got reported on the news, local news or something like that. And so it's not so exotic anymore. It's not just some random people out there, Arabs, Muslims, whoever, Palestinians. It's actually somebody they know, somebody who, like, I see them every week, and it makes it more normal as a concept. And I can say, like, I mean, I've had a couple of them ask me about the next protest or something that they could do, maybe not turn up to a protest, but something they could do to support. Can they donate somewhere? Is there some other event that they could learn more about what's going on? So that is part of I would encourage people not to think of attending a protest as just kind of like going up out and showing up and holding a sign. It's about how you communicate to your community, like what you're doing and bringing them along with you. And maybe some of those people will also turn up. And then your number turns from 1 to 5. And that starts growing and growing and growing. Or it maybe means that some people will start donating or contributing to causes that, you know, humanitarian or otherwise for Palestinians. Or just, you know, whatever it is, sparking those kinds of change and developing that kind of extended solidarity, I think, is part of how we build a movement. And also part of, like, how you start changing people's preferences or decisions they make politically. And yeah, it's a longer term process for sure. It's not sailing a boat to try to break through a naval blockade of a territory like Gaza. But different types of actions, different types of activities are for different people. And we need to maximize our participation in all those fronts in order to maximize the impact of this movement.
That was a conversation with Adam Shapiro, longtime human rights defender and activist, co-founder of the International Solidarity Movement in Palestine. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph, and thank you for listening. We air weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM at 11 a.m. on Wednesdays, on CGLO 1690 a.m., also in Geauguay, Montreal, on Wednesdays at 8:30 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg at 10:30 p.m. on Tuesdays, on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario at 11:30 a.m. on Wednesdays, on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, BC on Wednesdays at 9 a.m. and Saturdays at 7 a.m. on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto at 5:30 a.m. on Fridays, and now on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. We're also a podcast. Look us up on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search Free City Radio, and please tell a friend. The archives are up at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. Thank you for tuning in, and I will speak to you soon.